Today on the 21st,
you're stuck in this box by yourself, and you sit and sit and sit, and there's nothing there. You'd count every hole in the door, every hole in the wall.
Brian Nelson was in solitary confinement for 23 years. We'll learn about his story and talk about why a legal advocacy group in Chicago is suing the state of Illinois for the way it uses solitary confinement. And a new play coming to Central Illinois tells the stories of six troubled teens and their parents who are desperate to save them.
911, what is your emergency?
My son is locked in his room and he won't come out.
Is your son injured? Are you injured?
I don't know if he's passed out or he has his headphones on.
What is your location?
Open the door, please.
We talk with the Chicago-based director and co-writer of the play, Wilderness. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Solitary confinement is controversial. In some cases, the UN calls it torture, but many prison officials say it's necessary to protect safety. What does solitary look like in Illinois, and what's behind some of the recent efforts to reduce how often it's used? In Illinois, a legal advocacy group sued the Illinois Department of Corrections on behalf of six inmates, saying that some were put in extreme isolation for years. The suit argues that putting prisoners in these brutal conditions is unconstitutional. Earlier this month, the case took one step closer to becoming a class action. Brian Nelson was incarcerated and spent years in solitary confinement. He now works with the Uptown People's Law Center. Scott Cameron interviewed him late last week about what it was like to be in solitary.
So you're with the Uptown People's Law Center now, but you spent 26 years in prison. You're in TAMS, the maximum security prison that's now closed in southern Illinois. How much of that time, how much of your time was spent in solitary?
12 years at TAMS, but a total of 23 years in solitary.
23 years out of 26 years in solitary. For me and for a lot of people, the only reference point that we're going to have for your experience is what we might see on TV or in movies, the Hollywood versions. You told an Illinois House committee last year that those four walls beat me down so bad. Can you help us understand, what does it mean to be in solitary? What is that space like? What does that do to you?
Unless you're there, you'll never grasp it. It's as if the cell became a person. I spent 23 years in a gray box. The last 12 were in TAMS, and I had no human contact. No TV, no radio. If I had a visit, it would be through bulletproof glass. We were never allowed phone calls. And if I went to yard, I was always alone.
And when you say no human contact, I mean, there's none of the fellow offenders, the guards, interaction is what, minimal there?
There's none. The only time there would be contact is if I had to go to a doctor's appointment, and then two officers in complete tactical gear would come to my cell, strip search me, chain me hand and foot, and lock down the prison just to walk me to the infirmary.
Did you know the whole time how long you would spend? When you were first put into solitary confinement, did you know how long you were going to be there?
No, I did not violate any prison rules. I never received a disciplinary report. I was in a minimum security prison working as a trustee, and then within 24 hours I was in TAMS when they opened it. When I arrived there, I had no idea why I was there. Nobody there knew why I was there. And I remained there until I was 20 days from release.
So you don't know why you're there. You don't know how long you're going to be there.
No.
You're just stuck.
You're stuck in this box by yourself. And you sit and sit and sit. And there's nothing there. You'd count every hole in the door, every hole in the wall. I used to be able to recite off the top of my head, what's in toothpaste? Because it was the only thing I had to read or do. I began pacing to the point where I was pacing 18 hours a day. And depression set in real bad. When I arrived at TAMS, I was roughly about 185 pounds. And at my lowest point, I was down to 108 pounds. I literally lost the will to live.
Did you get any help? Did anybody notice?
Mental health treatment was sort of weird because they didn't know what to do. TAMS had just opened, and the mental health people that came there, they had no training. They had no education with solitary confinement or the effects. And there was a lawsuit filed, and two doctors from the outside came in and created a treatment plan for me. It was Dr. Catherine Burns and a Dr. Coopers. And if it wasn't for them, I don't think I would have survived TAMS. I became so depressed and lost, I turned to God. I copied the Bible word for word, the rule of St. Benedict's. I copied the catechisms of the Catholic Church, and I just prayed and prayed and prayed and tried to find a reason to keep going.
To keep going. It's 7 years now, I think, since you've been out of prison. How are you? How are you doing now?
I'm worse now than when I first got out. Every day that cell comes back to me. Every day the effects beat me down. When I first got out, it was easier because everything was so new out here. Mm-hmm. I had never seen a cell phone or anything. So I was caught up in learning all the new things and changes in society after 28 years. Now it's, I understand all that stuff, and I'm starting to feel what actually happened to me, how bad I was from TAMS. I see a forensic psychiatrist every week.
And you say, you know, every day, you know, it's getting worse. And you're talking, I mean, walking down the street, getting on a bus, riding a train, these are things that are difficult for you.
I cannot ride a bus. I can't get on a train. When that door closes, I start to panic. I get scared and terrified. I'm in self-imposed solitary now. At the law center, I work upstairs alone, and basically everybody just leaves me alone to work. At home, I'm alone most of the time, and it's what I know. From 14 years old to 46, I know how to be alone. I don't have social skills like the normal person does.
And I'm grateful that you're sharing this story with us. You have been speaking out on this issue for a number of years now, and I can hear it cannot be easy to talk about what happened, you know, on this show to state lawmakers, to other groups, but you're doing it. What do you want people to know? You know, what's driving you? What do you want them to know about what you went through?
I did something wrong, and I deserve to be held accountable for that. I didn't deserve what happened to me. 99% of the guys that were in TAMS with me that have been released, they're on Social Security because they can't handle a job. They sit in their basement most of the time. And we did something wrong. We're supposed to go and do our prison sentence, come out and be an asset to society. Instead, we're coming out so screwed up that we'll, for the rest of our lives, we'll be on Social Security, a burden to society. And I'm terrified of somebody that I care about killing themselves in solitary like I did. I starved myself to death in TAMS, and they wouldn't let me go. Instead, they put IVs in me and brought me back.
So at this point, you know, with the work you're doing and thinking about the struggle and what you're describing here, what do you hope to do for yourself and for others and for people who might be going into some of these prisons now? What are you hoping to change?
I'm hoping to stop it so no other mother goes through what my mom went through. My mom watched me slowly die. She watched me deteriorate, where every bone in my body was protruding, where I lost the will to live, I lost the will to do anything. And she didn't do anything wrong to deserve that. We're human beings. We did something wrong, but to do that to anybody is wrong. There's maximum security prisons. I mean, like I said, I was in a minimum security prison, a trustee, and then the next day, I'm in TAMS, and nobody ever told me why.
And that's where you stay.
I'm not a
from.
Monster.
And you're not a monster. We're going to talk more about some of the efforts to change things in Illinois and the lawsuit that we talked about from your organization here in just a moment. But, Brian, thank you very much. I just wish you the best of luck. You spent years in solitary confinement, now a prisoner's rights coordinator and investigator with the Uptown People's Law Center. Brian, again, thank you for coming on the show, and thank you for sharing your story with us.
Okay, thank you.
We're joined now from Chicago by Alan Mills. He's executive director of the Uptown People's Law Center. He works with Brian. Alan, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
So sort of building on what we just heard there, roughly how many people are in isolation in Illinois prisons?
There are close to 8,000 people who spend 22 to 24 hours a day locked in their cells with nothing to do in Illinois.
Okay, and that's—I mean—that Rangers gave their 22 to 24. There's some—we should probably clarify some terms here. You know,
sure.
We hear solitary confinement, isolation, segregation. What do those mean in the context of this conversation?
There's a couple different ways that Illinois, every state, uses different labels. So, sort of international standards have just adopted an across-the-board definition of anybody who involuntarily spends more than 22 hours a day in a cell without meaningful social contact is considered to be in solitary. Now, Illinois has two different groups of people that are in that category. One is people who are in disciplinary segregation. That is, they've been charged with violating some specific rule and have been put into segregation for a specific amount of time.
Okay.
The much larger group, and that's about a little under 2,000. The much larger group in Illinois, however, are those people who are in general population, generally in our maximum security prisons, although sometimes even in medium security prisons, mm-hmm. who are locked in their cells for that period of time just because there's nothing else for them to do. We've eliminated most jobs, most educational opportunities, and really the only time people get out of their cells for the vast majority of people is to go to chow, and that's only two meals a day now, and mm-hmm. they get about a half an hour total for those two meals, and then yard, which they get roughly 5 hours per week, and those are generally clumped on 1 or 2 days. So the other 5 days a week, they get out of their cells only a half an hour a day, and that's really it.
And you say that larger group, then, you say that because there's nothing else to do. Is that because they have gone through different sort of discipline processes and that's a last resort? Or is that, what do you mean
no,
there's nothing left to do?
No. Because we have no programming. There's no classes for them to go to, no place for them to go. So the default is you just stay in your cell. They haven't been disciplined for anything.
So there's nothing intentional, but it winds up being that. That's sort of that
Correct. Default
with it. Wow, okay.
Right. They haven't been sentenced to that. They just end up there because there's nothing else for them to do all day long.
So we mentioned the lawsuit earlier, the six Illinois inmates suing the Illinois Department of Corrections, legal representation from your organization and several law firms. Earlier this month, that case took one step closer to becoming a class action suit. What are the claims of that suit, and what are they asking for in that suit?
Well, we are asking that the use of this of segregation, and the lawsuit focuses on the smaller group of people, those that have been charged with doing something wrong. So the case asks that we not lock up people for such lengthy period of time. There are some people who have, I met one the other day, who has 90 more years to do in segregation, a absolutely meaningless number.
Who decides that?
And nobody decides that individually. What happens is you get sent to segregation for a set amount of time, like a year. And then once you're in segregation, you get additional disciplinary reports. Often these are people who are mentally ill and have a hard time conforming to rules without being properly treated.
Mm-hmm.
So it just accumulates, and somebody ends up with 1 year at a time or 30 days at a time or 60 days at a time, and they end up with 90 years in segregation earned over a period of time, which just is meaningless.
Yeah.
But we send people to segregation for lengthy periods of time for very little. So we also have a disproportionality claim saying that people, for example, get sent to segregation for things like insolence, which can mean rolling your eyes at a guard, or any actions you can take that a guard deems to be insulting.
Mm-hmm.
And we send people to solitary for 30, 60, 90, even a year for such minor violations as that. And we're saying that the proportionality of the punishment is totally out of whack. We're also arguing that the physical conditions in segregation are inhumane. Illinois segregation units are at most of them are at our three maximum security prisons, Menard, Pontiac, and Stateville. And all of those institutions were built decades ago. I think the newest ones were built in the 1920s. The state of corrections has changed dramatically over the last 100 years. Nobody builds the sorts of prisons we have now. These are generally small, airless cells, and they're not good for anybody, either mentally or physically.
Yeah. Is there any sort of review process? I mean, if someone is sent to isolation for 90 years or whatever, is there a way to appeal? Is there anybody who looks at that and says, does this make sense for this individual?
Each individual sentence is subject to appeal, but that's part of the problem is nobody steps back and says, all right, maybe this one-year sentence made sense in isolation, but 90 years doesn't. So there's not a process in Illinois where anybody looks at the overall picture and says, you know, if a year in segregation didn't solve this guy's problem, what makes us think that another 45 years are going to correct him, or another 90 years are going to correct him? Obviously, nobody's going to live that long, but and maybe we should try something else. So nobody is taking a sort of proactive approach to this, saying, what are we doing here, and does it actually make sense, and does it actually make anybody safer? And I think the answer is no, once you look at the larger picture.
Yeah, and there have been efforts.
That's really the essence of the lawsuit, is to say, Illinois, you have to start looking at the larger picture. You can't view each individual sentence individually. You've got to look at the effect on an actual human being.
And we hear that sort of that idea of, and if you see some proposals in the state legislature at the federal level to put in some more broad guidelines, restrictions, things like that. But we also hear, you know, prison officials in many cases argue that the prison guards and officials, they need the flexibility to segregate prisoners in order to protect, you know, staff and even other, you know, other inmates. You know, that it's a matter of safety in prisons.
Well, that's right. I mean, obviously safety is a large concern for everybody. But there are ways to segregate prisoners which don't require isolating them 24 hours a day from everybody for meaningful human contact. I mean, there are lots of technology, again, has advanced. So, for example, they have what are called restart chairs, where people, they look sort of like those chairs we all used to have in first grade with the little desks that fold over they were all one unit, except these have security so that people are strapped in. They can't stand up. They're bolted to the floor, so they can't use them as weapons. And that allows them to sit in a classroom and take classes while fully restrained. So there are lots of solutions to this problem of safety that don't require locking somebody in a box for 24 hours a day for years on end alone.
That's Alan Mills, Executive Director of the Uptown People's Law Center, speaking with Scott Cameron about solitary confinement in Illinois. We'll have more from that conversation after a short break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. We're continuing our conversation about solitary confinement in Illinois. Earlier, we heard from Brian Nelson, who spent 23 years in solitary. We're also hearing from Alan Mills, the executive director of the Uptown People's Law Center. Here's more of that conversation between Alan Mills and Scott Cameron.
Is there, you know, one of the things that I hear, and we do have a statement from the Department of Corrections, they could not make somebody or would not make somebody available for this conversation, but they did give a statement. And one of the things that I feel like I'm sensing from them is that idea of that flexibility. They're pushing back against sort of a blanket thing that limits number of days in isolation or in segregation. You know, they're asking for that kind of flexibility as opposed to a blanket restriction of some sort. Where is there a line there, or how do you see that that sort of tension playing out?
Well, I view this very simply. Under international standards, more than 15 days in segregation, in isolation, is considered torture. And frankly, I don't believe that we should have flexibility to torture people. After 15 days of complete isolation, then people's brains begin to change, and it rewires our thinking. And that is not a good thing to do to anybody. So I'm all in favor of flexibility. I just don't think total isolation from other human beings should be part of our arsenal for more than 10 or 15 days. Mm-hmm. I'm all in favor of all kinds of other things that they can try. And frankly, other states that have reduced their use of segregation, of this kind of total isolation, have found a drop in violence in their prison systems.
Hmm.
This sort of isolation, to the extent that it makes people more hostile and affects their brains, ultimately makes them more dangerous when they do get out into either general population or out into society, because they've really lost all those social skills. How do you deal with another human being? Isolation deprives you of that ability.
Do you think solitary confinement should be banned completely?
No, I think that it has a purpose. For example, if somebody is having a crisis and deteriorates and is lashing out at people and seems to be out of control, then isolating them for a period of time to figure out what's going on and then solving that problem is a good thing to do. But that should be a matter of hours or maybe days. It should not be a matter of years.
So I mentioned earlier we did reach out to the Department of Corrections. They gave us a detailed statement. One of the things they told us is, quote, the IDOC, Illinois Department of Corrections, does not use solitary confinement as a form of discipline, they said. in any of its facilities. It does, they said, segregate offenders who are being investigated for or who have been found guilty of violating rules and regulations. They go on to describe what some of those violations are: assaulting a staff member, another prisoner, having drugs or weapons. You know, there's a couple things that come in. One is the language and the wording that we talked about before. They're also saying that they limit the use of isolation, or what they're calling segregation, to cases where offenders have or are suspected of breaking rules. They're saying it's taken steps to reduce the number of people in isolation, the length of time. Are the steps they're taking enough, in your opinion?
No. I want to emphasize, I think that they've made a very good start. Over the last year, they've proposed and now enacted a series of regulations which will, in fact, reduce the penalties for some of the violations that they're talking about. So I absolutely commend that, and I think that they're working in the right direction. But I think that they're vastly underestimating the extent of the problem. As I said, the largest group is not those that are sentenced. The big problems are, one, this what I call stacking of segregation time, where you go in for one thing and you accumulate a whole lot of others. And the regulation does not stop that. But the other is the much larger group of people who are just sitting in their cells because we don't give them anything else to do. And that's not a group that they need flexibility for. They just need to give them something to do so they can get out of their cells. They're not there for disciplinary reasons.
What is this? I mean, this is an issue that's been talked about for you. You've been working on this issue for years now. You know, your lawsuit is ongoing efforts in the state house at the federal level, limiting the use of isolation. What is it going to take, do you think, to get some of the things that you're asking for?
Well, I think that the world is moving this way. Under the last presidential administration, even the president wrote an op-ed article explaining why solitary was a bad thing. Two different Supreme Court justices have now written statements, although not in binding opinions, suggesting that there is a serious problem with the excessive use of solitary confinement. And numerous states are working on or have already dramatically reduced their use of segregation. So I think that Illinois is somewhat behind the curve in this, although working to catch up, but not nearly quickly enough. I think that the science is part of it. That is, the medical profession has begun to study this seriously and is beginning to realize the depth of the harm that is inflicted on people through this kind of isolation. And then that is gradually getting out to the public at large. And I think in general, this idea that the only solution to misbehavior is punitive is also beginning to be re-examined society-wide. And you see this not just with solitary, but with the prison system as a whole. People are beginning to say, well, you know, maybe mass incarceration is not working. Maybe we should lock up fewer people and think about who we're putting in prison and why, and are there alternatives to prison? The way I look at it is, solitary is to prisons what prisons are to the larger society. And for the same reasons that we need to reduce the number of people we send off to prison, we also need to reduce the number of people we send off to solitary.
So it sounds like, for a number of reasons, you have some optimism at this point that there is the tide is shifting, and that not too far down the road things may change.
I'm not going to predict how long it's going to take. I definitely see a shift in tides, no question about it.
All right. Well, Alan Mills is executive director of the Uptown People's Law Center, one of the groups representing or working with the six inmates who are suing the state of Illinois over solitary confinement. Alan, thank you very much for talking with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. The plan put forth by the GOP to replace Obamacare was supposed to be voted on by the House last Friday, but that vote was called off when it became clear there would not be enough votes in support. Today, we step back to ask, where does that leave us now? And is Obamacare in Illinois at risk of exploding the way the Trump administration has predicted? To discuss all of this, we're joined on the line by Dr. Jerry Cruz, Dean and Provost of the Southern Illinois University School of Medicine and CEO of SIU Healthcare. Dr. Cruz, welcome back to The 21st.
Thank you so much. My pleasure to be on again.
Yeah, let's start out by asking you about the American Healthcare Act. You were among those who were concerned that that legislation would be bad for healthcare in Illinois. What was your reaction when you heard the vote fell through on Friday?
Well, my reaction was that that was a very good thing, that the American Healthcare Act did fall through at that point. There were many provisions that would have been very detrimental to the state of Illinois. So stepping back and taking a close look at this and making the improvements that really are needed to improve healthcare outcomes, lower costs and improve healthcare equity and access for all are the things that we really need to focus on now.
In previous conversations on our show, we've heard from some people who are, on the one hand, glad they have insurance coverage through Obamacare and thankful for the many positive things that were brought about because of it. But on the other hand, some are disgruntled because of the high costs. Here's Paul Taylor. He's a farmer in northern Illinois who we spoke with back in January.
Our costs in 2017 will be $2,200 a month with $6,000 each deductible. How do we fix it? I'm not sure. I just know that there's real issues. I think it's stymieing independent small farmers, folks that don't have opportunities to get insurance through perhaps a spouse's employment or off-farm employment or Medicare. And it's tough on the small business people in rural communities that try to run a machine shop, a painting business, other things, and have $20,000 a year of health care costs.
One of the arguments from critics of the ACA is that it simply has been unaffordable for many people, so they want to do away with it entirely. What do you see as the solution to the problem of rising costs?
Well, when we talk about rising costs, there are several segments within the healthcare industry. When we talk about Obamacare itself, that has to do with the marketplace insurance. And, you know, that's about 13 million people across the country and only about 350,000 in the state of Illinois. I think a lot of other people see their own premiums going up in their commercial private insurance outside of the insurance exchanges as well. Interestingly enough, I think the solutions for that are pretty much the same. And they fit into several major categories. One of them is that there needs to be significantly more regulation of the insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and the medical device industry. The ACA and Obamacare recognized that when that came into being in 2010, there was one part of that bill that called for an 85% medical loss ratio for healthcare insurance companies, and I thought that if that was applied across the system, that that could save up to $100 to $200 billion per year. Now, medical loss ratio is a concept that's defined by what percent of the premium collected are spent on healthcare costs. So a medical loss ratio of 65% means that 65% is spent on healthcare and the other 35% is spent on profits and marketing, executive administration, and things like that. In the United States, that's about where we were in 2010, was a medical loss ratio of 65%. Across the world, in the best functioning systems, those medical loss ratios are 90% or 95%. But when the ACA came in very quickly, there was a little bit of a new definition of medical loss ratio in the ACA itself, which actually helped water it down a little bit. And then I think there were some loopholes there that were found pretty easily. So over the years of the ACA, from 2014 until now, we really haven't seen a drop in that medical loss ratio. So I think that is a great opportunity to really cut some costs. The other thing I'd say is that we really need to keep universal health care insurance coverage and access for all. When everyone is covered, the costs to the system are actually less. An uninsured person's cost to the system, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, is $1,700 per year that the system needs to pick up. And that's a lot of money. You know, that's in the order of $20 to $30 billion per year for the uninsured people that we have right now. And the other thing I'd say is we have an opportunity now for less regulation. I think there, through the ACA, there was a lot of regulation on small businesses and on healthcare providers that would really help if we lessen those a little bit. And the other important thing is that I think there needs to be a bit higher emphasis on primary care and more incentives for better primary care throughout the system so that as access is improved to usual sources of comprehensive longitudinal care. And that can be accomplished in a variety of ways also.
Okay. If health insurance premiums do continue to rise, or deductibles as well for that matter, some experts predict that more people, even those who need insurance, would simply just choose to opt out and take the penalty. Is that something that concerns you?
It does. There needs to be some mechanism so that can't occur. Now, it is. I do think that people should have a wide range of choices, and that younger, healthier people could opt for plans that are more catastrophic type coverage. I think that would be okay to have that menu of choices for sure. But really, for the best system, everybody needs to be covered by insurance and have the access to care. The other thing I'll say about that is over the last 8 years, the insurance premiums have actually gone up less than they did in the decade before that. So we've just started to see another start of some healthcare inflation that actually had been flat for about 6 years, for a six-year period of time.
The Trump administration, in fact, President Trump himself on Twitter, has warned that Obamacare is on the verge of exploding. Is that something that you could see happening here in Illinois?
No, I really couldn't see that happening in the state of Illinois. Again, the people covered in the state of Illinois are the 650,000 expanded Medicaid recipients and about 350,000 people on the health insurance exchange. In October of 2016, healthcare.gov put out statistics that allowed estimates for increases in healthcare premiums for the next year. Those estimates came out immediately in the first week of November and turned out to be a little bit higher than actual. But across the nation, there are about 22 to 25% increases in premiums. In the state of Illinois, it's a little bit higher than that. It was estimated to be about 40 to 45% for the Chicago area before the subsidies kicked in. Now, after the subsidies kick in, that increase is only about 5%, and that covers about 80% of the people in the exchange who get those subsidies. The state of Illinois has lost two major insurers for the exchanges, and so they'll drop from 7 to 5 next year. But again, there are plenty of insurance companies to cover the people. The premiums are really quite affordable. 60% of the 350,000 people will pay $100 a month or less for their insurance. The ones that seem to be most affected are those 20% who won't get any subsidies on the exchange. And I think we'll really have to examine those very carefully to see how we can help those folks out.
One final question. We've got just about 90 seconds left here. Where do you think we go from here? What do you want Congress and the Trump administration to think about as we try to find a way forward on this issue?
I would just say that, first of all, we need to step back and take a look at the larger picture. We have a highly complex amalgamation of private and public structures and processes. There's nothing like it in the world. And we need to simplify our system and pick one healthcare system instead of four. And then we just need to make sure that we emphasize universal coverage, that we emphasize regional healthcare planning to really target various areas for what they really need, that we get the balanced workforce that we need, and the regulation of the insurance industry as well. I think those are the main messages that Congress needs to hear as we move forward.
Dr. Jerry Cruz is the Dean and Provost of the Southern Illinois University School of Medicine and CEO of SIU Healthcare. Dr. Cruz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Brian.
Still to come today on the 21st, we'll hear some voices and from the director of a play called Wilderness that's on stage tonight in Urbana at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. That's coming up next on the 21st. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st.
I dive into the swamp only to find that it's a night sky.
I used to break down doors when I was screaming at my mom. Flip the table, pull the knife out on her once.
I tried to run my mom over with my car.
I used to drive high, and I would go fast. 110, 120. I went really fast with my sister in the back seat. She's 12, almost 13.
My mom was like, I want a divorce. And my dad cleaned her out financially. And then they got the divorce. And then he didn't pay any child support.
You know, he had PTSD, severe anxiety disorder, depression, and ADHD.
You see your kids sort of tormenting from the inside out. And you're like, what do I do?
Those are some of the voices and music from the band Towers that is part of the score, that are part of a play called Wilderness that will be on stage tonight in Urbana at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. It's about a therapy program for troubled teens who spend nearly 3 months in the wilderness working through their struggles with substance abuse, mental illness, and other challenges. The documentary theater piece features the story of six teen participants in the camp and their parents, weaving together live performance, documentary interviews, and an original acoustic score. A note to our audience, for the next 15 minutes, we'll be discussing this play, which takes on a number of sensitive topics, including sexual abuse. I'm joined now by the director and co-writer of the play, Seth Boakley. He teaches at the University of Chicago and is an artist in residence at the Goodman Theater in Chicago. Seth, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brian.
Part of your preparation for writing this play was spending some time out of wilderness therapy camp. Can you tell us what that's like?
What it's like to spend time out there as a client, or what it was like for me to go out and research?
Maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah, well, wilderness therapy is a form of intervention for parents and kids where, you know, a young person, traditionally a teenager, is sent out to a therapeutic environment out in the wilderness in a place like Utah or rural Oregon. And in the case of our play, we look at a program that brings primarily teenagers, teenage clients, out to the high desert of southern Utah. And those kids spend, as you said, around 11 weeks or even sometimes more hiking around, learning survival skills, undergoing intensive group therapy, one-on-one therapy, while they're also learning, how to again survive and live out in the wilderness. So it's a sort of radical form of intervention for parents who feel like they've come to a sort of dead end with other ways of reaching a child who may be suffering from anything from a kind of profound trauma, self-harm, addictions of various kinds, eating disorders, et cetera, and to the point where that parent feels that they can't reach that child. And they make this often excruciating decision to ship their kid out to the desert to go through this kind of program. And in the course of researching this play, my co-writer Annie Hamburger and I did spend about 10 days out in the desert with a series of groups, boys groups and girls groups. The groups are gender segregated traditionally, and we moved around and saw how their day-to-day therapy and wilderness work was. And we slept on the ground with those groups and really spent some time studying them and along the way picked up these stories that we ended up weaving together into our live production.
Yeah, you interviewed, as you mentioned, dozens of teens who had been through wilderness camp. How did you go about picking the six whose stories are featured in this play?
You know, we had a really unusual and fortunate opportunity because we worked directly with one program that was willing to kind of give us, a number of names of parents. And we started with the parents and said, would you be willing to sort of share your story with us and with the world, hopefully, ultimately. And we found that there were many, many families who were willing, not only for, where the parents were willing to speak about their experiences doing this, but were also the kids themselves who had just, in many cases, just very, very recently returned from this wilderness therapy, were willing to speak. And so it was really through the program itself that we initially found them. But then as we got to know them, we just followed up. And, they were able to, I think, put the experience of wilderness therapy into context as a part of the story about their family. You know, ultimately, it isn't just about this experience of being sort of shipped out to the desert, but is about six families. What they went through that led to this decision and what it was like to be out there for the kids. And for the parents to be, to have their kid gone and writing letters literally they do a lot of handwriting of letters when they're out there, and then to be reunited. So it's really the story of families as much as it is a story about wilderness therapy.
Sure. I'd like to play a little audio from a prior recording of the play. We have a scene here where Michael's taking part in a group therapy session, followed by a recording of Michael's mother explaining her perspective as a parent.
My father was definitely the source of most, if not all, of my major difficulties, like, you know, just in general. Beginning in childhood and then negatively blossoming into something more when I was older. He raped somebody. I don't know who, but he raped somebody. Somebody! I don't know who!
At the end of June, I got a call from a therapist, and my son had revealed to him some horrible things that had happened at the hands of my ex that I was not aware of. When I heard that news, it kind of everything fell into place, and I'm like, that's what was killing my kid from the inside out.
That's a scene from the play Wilderness. I'm speaking with the director and co-writer of the play, Seth Boakley. And by the way, that'll be performed tonight in Urbana at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. We'll tweet out all that information if you follow us at 21st Show. We'll also have that information available at our website. Seth, what was it about Michael's story in particular that made such a strong impression in your mind that you decided that he would be one of the six stories presented on stage?
Yeah, we love Michael and his mother, Mary, who you heard there. They're a tremendously giving people who were so generous with their story. And it's a heartbreaking story, as you could hear from the clip that you just played. Michael is someone who's gone through trauma, who has come out the other side of it as a survivor. He's also somebody who, you know, prior to the wilderness therapy program that he went through, was a very angry person and a destructive force in his family's life. And, you know, all that being said, the reason that one of the reasons we love Michael is because he's funny. He's a really, really funny guy. And actually, he's transmuted a lot of his pain into a very sharp sense of sarcastic humor about his life, about going to wilderness. You know, he's a kind of character who couldn't believe that he would be ripped away from, you know, the electronic media and, you know, fast food and all of the things that he expects, you know, out of modern life. And he just was incredulous that he would have to, you know, cook his own food over a campfire and sleep out under the stars. And, you know, so he has a really funny streak that his mother shares as well. So even though you couldn't hear it in that clip, one of the reasons we love having his story in the show is both that it's a profound story of trauma and healing, but also because he's kind of the class clown of the show, as it were.
Sure. One of the other great things about this play is it incorporates an original score with music from the band Towers. You heard a little bit of their work at the beginning of this interview. It also includes some choreography. That wasn't necessarily part of the plan when you set out to write this play. What made you decide to include dance as a component?
You know, we felt that in many cases, the emotional turbulence that's underneath the experience of these teenage characters isn't expressed in words. You know, when we were out there in Utah, we realized that whatever might be said in a group therapy situation or just whatever the experience of going on internally to these kids as they're hiking and sort of carrying these heavy packs around mountains and through valleys wasn't necessarily apparent on the surface. You know, what this emotional life, this again turbulent fear, hope, joy, discovery, these things weren't always communicated through language, and we felt like we should find a different language, a language of music and movement that would express those deep emotions. So that's really where dance came from.
You don't shy away from portraying the messiness of the situation that many of these teens have found themselves in, and you don't shy away from some of the more controversial aspects of wilderness therapy camps, including the method by which many of the teens were brought from their homes to the camp in Utah. Let's listen to a piece from that conversation between some of the teens at the camp.
I got gooned
That's when strangers come in the middle of the night and take you to Utah.
Almost everyone in my group got gooned.
I got gooned.
Yeah, I got gooned.
I did not get gooned.
It's actually called transporting.
I got woken up at like 4 in the morning.
They just said you're going to the wilderness. They said your parents are already on board.
Like I knew. I knew something was going to happen.
I was in a mental hospital at the time.
They said, fine, you can leave, but you can't, you know, you're not going home.
I mean, I was being taken away by complete strangers to go somewhere where I didn't know where it was to do something that I had no clue about.
When you approach a subject like Wilderness Therapy Camp, which has received some negative attention in the past for things like transporting methods, I wonder if you can share a bit about how you decided how to tackle some of that on stage.
Well, these camps are controversial, and the camps themselves are controversial. The prospect of transporting, as you suggest, in some cases a 14, 15, 16-year-old young person is ripped out of their bedroom in the middle of the night and taken essentially against their will to a camp, as the character said, not knowing where they're going. And sure, that has been controversial. And we found that the best way to represent that was to honestly tell about the experience through the voices of people who have lived through it rather than editorializing about it. So, you know, we find that the young people themselves have a lot to say, and we wanted to use their words. And all of the words in that sequence that you just played are verbatim quotations. So these actors are portraying characters whose words we recorded in interviews, and then they are literally reproducing them. So, you know, this is a faithful reproduction of their point of view. And overall, we felt that this story of wilderness is a kind of a Rashomon story. You know, you're looking at an experience from multiple perspectives. In this case, from the parents' perspective, who might feel, wow, this transporting thing is the only way we can reach this kid, and the kid who feels this is an unbelievable injustice. And we wanted to give both of those points of view weight and a hearing in our show.
What do you hope that people in the audience will walk away with from this performance of Wilderness?
I hope that people will walk away from this performance tonight with a sense of hope, a sense of the possibility of reconciliation, of reconnecting with somebody that they may feel is lost, with a kind of hope. I hope an inspiration to reach out and to not consider that any relationship has been permanently lost. You know, these are ultimately stories of reconciliation between parents and children, sometimes undergoing some of the most profound trauma and alienation imaginable, and yet, in many cases, they come out stronger. So I hope that regardless of whether someone in the audience is a parent or a child who is experiencing some of these things, that they can come out with that sense of hope that healing is possible.
Seth Boakley is the director and co-writer of Wilderness, which will be performed on stage tonight in Urbana at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. We'll tweet out all of the details if you follow us at 21st Show, and that information will also be available on our website. Seth Boakley, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And here's another original song from Wilderness by Towers. It's called House of Stone. That's all we have time for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background of what we're discussing. On our Facebook, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Hala Delahi, Christine Herman, and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thank you so much for listening. We're
so